Hi, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. Looking at a rat is like looking in a mirror. And I don't mean that as an insult. I'm sure you're very attractive. What I mean is that rats are reflective of the human experience. They hitched along with humans as we migrated to every corner of the globe. And today, their presence in a city can tell us a lot about the state of affairs, or perhaps the state of disrepair. And that's why Drexel professor Jason Munchie South studies rats. He recently published an article in the journal Science about the remarkable evolutionary history of rats. In short, they're everywhere we are. When we sat down recently, we started by talking about rats as survivors. We are taping this conversation on a cold January day. How are the rats surviving out there? Like, how are these rats able to survive harsh winters like we have in Philadelphia and places far further north?
Yeah, that's a great question. They do have their limits. You know, the colder it gets, the less likely a rat is going to survive. It's harder for them to find food. You know, their burrows may not protect them from the coldest nights. But they are a hardy animal. You know, they can find places underground like sewers and subway tunnels that protect them from the elements. Their burrows themselves are pretty robust, but, you know, and if we do get these cold snaps, some of the rats will die back. I found, you know, in recent years on the East Coast, our winters just aren't as cold as they used to be. We're having a bit of a cold winter so far this year, but I think that actually helps bolster the rat population, you know, that we've had these warmer winters in recent years.
So they have, even in a natural state, no humans, they would have burrows underground where they could protect themselves against the elements, but we've also created burrows for them, in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. They love to dig burrows into soil, so you'll find them in small little pocket parks around the city under bushes. They build these tunnels, but they are perfectly happy to live in a sewer where there's, you know, food floating along that gets washed down the drains, the storm drains, and subway tunnels, you know, where there's access to food people have thrown on the tracks, and that stays a nice, you know, 50, 60 degrees you know, all year.
Yeah, climate controlled. And I guess it speaks to the broader point of they're just really good at taking advantage of, or not, that's probably the wrong word, but like using the things that we have created to adapt and survive. Like it feels like they're better at that than many, many, many other types of animals.
Yeah, that's right. This type of animal, you know, brown rats and other species like this that live along with us, we call them commensal species, and that in Latin means eating from the same table. So that tells us a little bit about what they're doing. You know, we store food, they find it, they take advantage of it. We throw away food, they find it, they eat it. And that has been an incredibly successful strategy for them.
Why are they able to do that, but seemingly other species who might be like the same size, you know, also be pretty agile, like don't do that as well?
That's a really interesting question. We don't know for sure why some species have evolved to live with humans and take advantage of our resources. Some of it is probably luck.
Yeah.
This species was, you know, hanging out in Eastern Asia, and humans developed agriculture there a long time ago. You know, we're talking about starting maybe 9,000 years ago. And so they had thousands of years to develop this relationship with agricultural peoples in what is now modern day China.
Right place, right time.
Yeah. And so, you know, they evolved there. They evolved this close relationship with people, and then they started spreading out. And it's actually, for this species, the brown rat or Norway rat, which is the one you see in Philadelphia, it took a while for them to get here. You know, they were in Asia for a couple million years. Probably in the last several thousand years, they evolved this relationship with people. We think, based on genetic results, that they only spread into Southeast Asia maybe like 1,000 years ago, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, pretty recent.
Yeah, very recent. And they didn't make it to Europe until the early 1700s at the earliest.
We should establish how widespread the brown rat is.
So basically anywhere with permanent or even semi-permanent human settlement with enough resources, brown rats have been introduced there. They're most abundant and common in urban areas and agricultural areas. But they even live places where humans aren't if humans introduce them there. So there are, you know, islands even down by Antarctica where there are brown rats living because humans dumped them there off of a ship, either intentionally to get them off the ship or more likely accidentally. And they're just surviving by, you know, eating seabirds and insects and things like that. Yeah, so they're incredibly adaptable to a wide range of conditions.
How rare is it for a species to be that widespread? Because I think, like, we generally don't really know, like the species that we have here. Do they exist other places? Like, we probably just don't even know that. The reach of the brown rat, is it unparalleled? Are there other species that are somewhat similar?
There are a handful of rodents that are similar. So the house mouse, the black rat to a lesser extent than the brown rat, but still very successful. And then the brown rat and a few others like the Polynesian rat have been spread around. But to give you some context, you know, there are more species of rodents than any other mammal. There's something like 2,000 species of rodents. And there's only, you know, 5 or 6 that have been very successful and only 3 that have really achieved a near global distribution. So this is a pretty rare evolutionary event for a species to spread like this.
So talking about the rarity of this, I imagine that gets us into this conversation of why study rats and what can rats tell us about us?
Right. So, you know, I actually started my career working in tropical rainforests, studying native species, including rodents. And then when I moved to New York City, when I got my first faculty job, I was working on native rodents in city parks, trying to understand how they survive and how they deal with an urban environment. But what everybody wanted to know about was rats. Journalists, family members, everybody want to know about rats. They had a rat story they wanted to tell me, you know, about the rat that came
Jason,
out of their toilet.
I hear you know about rodents. I got a rat question for you.
No, absolutely. And they all have a horror story. A rat, you know, crawled over my foot in the subway. It came out of my toilet. You know, everybody has a story like that.
Yes.
And so, you know, I realized, you know, we don't know that much about this super common species that's all over the place. There were a number of great field studies done, in particularly in Baltimore in the 40s and 50s, that tracked rats moving around in backyards and alleys. And there's thousands of studies that have been done on rats in the lab, but not a huge amount to understand what they're doing out there in the world and how they spread. So we asked kind of 2 parallel questions. The first thing was, how did rats get to North America, to places like New York City and Philadelphia? And that turned into a larger study looking at relationships of rats around the world. Could we piece together their entire history? And then on a very local level, we are interested in how rats use the urban landscape. How do they move around? Are they using subway tunnels? Are they traveling through green areas? Are they taking advantage of residential neighborhoods more than other types of neighborhoods? So we ask those kinds of parallel questions. So, you know, by studying rats, we learn not only about their history, but about the history of humans and shipping networks and trade routes and imperialism and all these sorts of things that brought rats around the world. And
can you give me an example of that? Like what's something that you or someone in your field has uncovered that helped us understand something about human evolution and movement that we either didn't know before or were like a little fuzzy on?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things is when we were doing our study, we weren't sure exactly what the relationships would be amongst all these rat populations around the world, but we found this signal of dozens of rat populations all across the Americas, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Africa, that were all closely related and all basically dated to the period of the height of European imperialism. So, you know, mostly in the 1700s into the early 1800s was this period where rats were just brought everywhere.
Yeah. And I think what you're getting at is the idea that colonialism didn't just impact human affairs. It really impacted the ecosystem up and down the animal chain. I mean, this has remade our landscapes. It's remade who's competing for resources among humans, but also among animals.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this massive ecological legacy of that period that is maybe underappreciated. And this handful of commensal species like the house mice and the brown rat are part of that. And then there are also, you know, dozens of plants and insects and other species that were brought that had escaped or intentionally let out in the environment, you know, as part of that whole process.
You're doing all of this inquiry into rat and human history and migration. What can we, or what are we hoping to learn through further study? Like, what's your big burning question?
Yeah, I think we're getting closer to understanding when rats first arrived in various locations in Europe and North America as, you know, genetic estimates get better and we obtain more archaeological remains. Another type of study we're doing is basically an attempt to understand rat populations in individual cities so that we can better manage the city to keep the rat population down. Our typical approach is to, you know, poison and trap rats reactively when we know they're there, but that's not very effective. So what my lab has been doing is working in multiple cities, particularly New York City, but in other places with collaborators, to sample rats across an entire city and then use genetics to understand how those rats are related across a landscape. And they basically form like neighborhoods and villages that you can detect genetically because rats don't move very far. So rats in one part of a city are distinguishable from rats in another. And we can use that information to build models of how they migrate and what parts of a city they use to move around. And then we can build kind of an estimate of how big of a chunk of the city do you have to attack to actually control the population.
And what would attack mean in this case?
Well, it would be sort of a full-bore effort to remove the resources available to rats. So if you identify, say...
Sounds like food to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Get rid of the food.
That's the key. You know, let's say if we did the same analysis in Philadelphia and we found that, you know, University City was a distinct rat population because the Schuylkill River's there, they can't cross that very well, and then they don't maybe go that far into West Philadelphia for various reasons. We could demarcate that zone and work with all the local property owners and businesses to better control garbage, provide containers, provide enhanced pickup. I tend to think that fining people and, you know, passing out violations is the wrong way to go about it. We want everyone to be on the same page, but that could be part of it as well.
Yeah.
You know, to basically remove those resources from rats. And if you do it on a large enough scale, you're capturing that entire village of rats in that part of the city, and they will decline over time.
Is that something we want to do? Because then you get in these weird situations, even in this case where they're only here because of us, these rats, but they now are part of the urban ecosystem, and I don't know if they're food for someone else or the fact that they eat this helps that species. Like, we want to control rats because we find them icky, I guess, but is that like ecologically sound?
Yeah, that's in some ways more of a philosophical question than a scientific one.
Yeah.
You know, what species belong in a particular area? You know, rats did not evolve in this landscape.
But they are invasive.
Yeah, but again, this is a landscape that humans created, right? It's not It's not like any kind of an original landscape. But I would argue that, you know, rats do impose a cost on human communities. They do spread disease to some degree. They damage infrastructure. They can wreck your car. And when we poison them, you know, that poison gets out into the environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, a sick rat may be walking around and get eaten by a hawk or a coyote or a dog.
Yeah.
And then that poisons that animal. So all those things are negative. It's also been shown that people can experience psychological distress from having rats in their neighborhood and particularly like in their house. So that's a reason we may want to control them. I would say, you know, getting back to your question of whether we should think about them as part of the ecosystem, I would say, you know, we shouldn't be cruel to them, and we have to realize this is an intelligent animal that's social and is just trying to live its life. That's why I favor strategies that are likely to work, like removing access to food. Over time, the population will decline on its own, rather than just trying to poison and kill as many of them as we can, because we already know that doesn't work, and it also has other negative outcomes. There's also something we haven't talked about is, you know, the history of how the rat was domesticated. So we've been talking mostly about wild rats that live in cities, but the lab rat and pet rats are the same species. And they were domesticated intentionally by humans for various reasons, not just one reason. You know, there are old breeding manuals from Japan in the 1700s for how to take care of pet fancy rats. They used to use them... round them up in England and then use them in these horrible like blood sports where they put them in a ring and like have
like
a dog
cock
kill them.
Fighting for rats.
Well, it was usually a dog trying to kill the rats.
Oh my gosh.
They would bet on how many they could kill. And apparently as part of that process, there was early domestication because they would keep the rats in pens and stuff. And every now and then there'd be like a white one or a black one and they'd keep those. And that was kind of an early domestication in Europe. And then later, you know, they were intentionally domesticated for lab work.
Yeah. Which, by the way, Philadelphia is a huge part of that story, right?
Yeah, that's right. This is not actually something I was strongly aware of when we started this work, because I was interested in wild rats. But reading more about the history of the lab rat, Philadelphia played a key role. So there was a guy, Henry Donaldson, who was working in Chicago and founded a rat colony there. We don't have many details on it. But then he moved to Pennsylvania. He worked at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia at a place called the Wistar Institute. And he brought some rats with him and founded some very well-known inbred lines of rats. The Wistar rats are famous in lab research and still used today. And he had a colleague a few years later, Helen Dean King, who joined the Wistar Institute and worked there for decades. And she developed several other important strains of rats, like the brown Norway rat. And that's a really interesting one, because she actually went out and caught wild rats in Philadelphia to found that strain. And it's another one you can still purchase today for lab studies.
Yeah, it's amazing to think of a scientist at the Wistar Institute just trapping a rat on the street of Philly. And that led to who knows, you know, how many other rats that were used in research, and what conclusions and breakthroughs were drawn off of that. I mean, tracing it all back to some rat in the street of Philadelphia.
Yeah,
it's like mind-blowing.
Thousands of studies, millions of descendant rats.
Yeah.
It is really remarkable. So Philly played a strong role there. And even if you look at the genetics of lab rat strains today, Wistar ancestry is all over the place.
Yeah.
And the records have not always been well kept, but you can see it in the genomes. And this is not the only place people worked on this. There were parallel efforts in Asia and
totally. And
other institutions, but the Wistar Institute was a real pioneer in developing the lab rat as an animal for research.
They say Philly is the city of firsts. And I say I am proud that we were among the first there as well. Jason Munchie South is a professor of environmental science at Drexel. Thanks so much for coming in today into our borough.
Of course.
And I appreciate the time. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Paige Marie Bessler. Charlie Kyer engineered this podcast episode. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thanks for joining me.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?